Welcome to Talking Anthropology. And today's show consists of two separate interviews. The first one is with Eric Hirschman from the IHOP in Nairobi in Kenya. And the second one who follows up is with Valerie Cologne from the Active Space in Cameroon. Yeah, I hope you enjoy the show and learn something about Africa. Welcome to Talking Anthropology. Today we have a new show about Africa and African hackerspaces and African IT industry. And today's interview partner is Eric Hirschman, who is sitting right now in the IHOP, the Innovation Lab in Nairobi. Hello, Eric.
Hi, Thomas. How are you?
I'm fine. It's quite a busy day, but I'm very happy that finally we came to make this interview.
Yes.
Not as good prepared as I would like to be, because it was all a bit spontaneous, but I think it doesn't matter. We have enough interesting things to talk about.
We'll make do with what we have.
Yeah. Maybe you start by introducing yourself, giving the audience a brief background of you, what you do, where you come from.
Sure. My name is Eric Hirschman. I'm a technology blogger and we also am the co-founder of an application called Ushahidi and one of the founders of the Innovation Hub here in Nairobi, the iHub. I grew up in Sudan and Kenya, and I've been doing a lot of either technology or just general work out here for my whole life. And so I got into technology a dozen years ago, and ever since then I've been enthralled with how it can be used in Africa in ways that aren't generally expected from the West.
And what's your engagement in Africa? I mean, you're now in the IHOP. Did you study in university, or were you autodidactical and teached everything to yourself?
No, I did go to university. I went to the U.S. for university, and after I graduated, I started my first business back here in Kenya, and over time, got into technology. I mean, the short story is that my first business after a couple of years didn't work out, and so I swore off anything to do with inventory and got into technology, because I figured that at least there's not as much there's not as many barriers to entry, and you also don't have to deal with some of the repercussions of bricks and mortar stores in this online space.
Mm. So your tech focus was always on online, on web design, web development, or are you also have a hardware background?
Well, I have a soft spot for hardware hacking, but it's not anything I've done professionally. I run a blog called AfriGadget. AfriGadget is a site about hacking hardware in Africa. It's local innovation and local micro entrepreneurs doing things. But no, my specialty is more in the software side. Mobile and web are the two areas where I've spent a lot of time.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk about that anyway when we come to your interesting project. But maybe let's stick to the hardware thing. Can you tell us something? What are the interesting spots about the hardware scene in Africa?
Yeah, the interesting things about hardware in Africa have to deal with what you get that you don't realize is out there. So, for example, we have a lot of really ingenious, inventors, if you will, here. And a lot of that comes in the mundane things you see on the side of the road. But every once in a while, you see this hacking taking place between some higher technology stuff like mobile phones and lower tech things that you wouldn't think of. We have guys who have created alarm systems for both cars and homes that can be triggered via SMS messages, and we've even had a guy who's created an alert via SMS for phishing. So when he catches a fish or the net moves, it'll send a signal via SMS to him, and he knows where to go and pick up his catch. So I mean, there's some pretty interesting things like that that aren't the norm, but you see from time to time, and it's a lot of fun to play around with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the mobile technology sector is very, very large and still growing in Africa. I mean, there's also a payment system which is based on SMS. So
yeah, M-Pesa.
Yeah, and I mean, is this because of the lack of normal internet bandwidth in most areas, that the people get creative and then build the systems based upon what's already there, the mobile network, or?
Yeah, well, I think it's a combination of a couple things. But yeah, definitely one of them is that, you know, when you're in Western Europe or even Eastern Europe in the U.S., Japan, places like that, you have a lot of payment options. In Africa, there are. You know, very few people have credit cards, just a small percentage of the whole population that is banked. Very few people are banked. And so, you know, when M-Pesa came up, when these mobile payment systems started to rise up, they offered a way for people to pay and do things with the tools they already had instead of having to go out and do something else. And so it quickly caught on, especially here in Kenya. And, you know, right now with M-Pesa alone, they move more money internally in the country than they do, than Western Union does globally in a single day. Mm.
It's crazy. I mean, when you think of that, this is also a working and stable micropayment system, something which the West hasn't got so far. I mean, we have the single and we have Flatter. I mean, yeah, it's more social payment what they do, but for Africa, this already works. That I guess that the amount of money per transaction is quite low, and still it is a working system.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, the transaction cost too is minimal. It's the equivalent of about 30 cents in euros. You know, so it's 30 euro cents, and so that's you know, barely anything. And you can, for that amount of money, you can move as little as 1 euro and up to 70 up to 700 euros. So it's a pretty, you know, sizable chunk of money that you can move for a very small transaction fee. And quite frankly, the incumbents, the banks, and organizations like that, they can't compete at that transaction cost. And so the mobile operators sit in a really sweet spot because they have the agent network that allows it to happen, and they have the ability to take low transaction costs, which means there's very few competitors in the same space.
How is the general opinion or the, I don't know, the awareness for this technology and innovation in Africa? Do the people really go for the new modern possibilities, or are they quite resilient to this innovation?
Well, yeah, it's a different kind of innovation, right? So things that people need already that are important to their everyday life are picked up right away. So things like micropayments or just payments via mobile phones right away, right? But things like the internet as a whole, they might or might not use. You know, that's something that is a little bit more of a want than a need right now. And so it's not picked up by the huge population that's out there. I'm just throwing around some numbers. For example, in Kenya, we have about 40 million people, and about 6 million of them have internet access. So it's a smaller percentage than you would find in other more developed countries. Now, having said that, it's a much larger percent of the population that's connected here than in many other African countries. So even across Africa, there's a whole spectrum of countries and populations that are connected, aren't connected, are using technology, aren't using technology. And it varies greatly depending which country you're talking about.
Exactly. That's what I feel responsible to point out as an anthropologist, that Africa is not a monolithic continent. It is a very diverse place with many different levels of development, different histories, different skills and problems, and to speak generally about Africa is impossible anyway, I think. But
yeah,
we're focusing about on Kenya. What do you think, how is the IT industry here? Is this a large part of the economy, or is it, I sometimes think just because of the general education level, it has to be somehow an elite, very high class of the population that engages in really working in IT.
Yeah, you know, that's a good thing to point out too. Right now, I would say it's primarily middle-class Kenyans and above who are the ones who grew up with either computers in a school, or they came across it in university, or had the money to pay for it at a cyber cafe when they were younger. You know, because generally speaking, most technologists pick up the use of computers by the time they're, you know, in their teens. And that isn't different in Kenya, than it is anywhere else in the world. So there's a smaller subset of the population that are programmers and web designers and, you know, just general IT people. However, saying that, I think it's important to point out that one of the big, people like to talk about the digital divide, and it's got a whole bunch of problems. But if we take that term and we apply it to Africa, a lot of people like to point out the digital divide between people with wealth and people without wealth. And I think that's a changing, it's a moving target. And in Africa, what we're seeing, and this is not just in Kenya, this is in other countries as well, it's more of an urban versus rural thing now. Mm-hmm. If you're in the urban areas, you have access to mobile phones, you have access to faster networks and computers, and things that people in the rural areas don't have nearly as much of or have access to nearly as easily. And so the urban versus rural side of technology is much more interesting than the, rich versus poor.
Mm-hmm. One thing I always wondered about was if, generally speaking, open source software is more popular in Africa than normal commercial software operating systems and so far.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there actually is quite a bit of interest in open source systems here because of the lack of, they're not quite as expensive as their proprietary counterparts, generally speaking. But the technologists here go, like anywhere else in the world, they have to make money. And so they go towards and work for either the companies or organizations who are hiring for certain things. So in a lot of cases, you're talking about the international NGOs or the large corporates that base their organizations in either Southern or Eastern Africa. You will find, some .NET developers. You will find, organizations who use closed source type technologies.
Mm-hmm. And is there a working copyright enforcement in Kenya? Do you have problems if you start pirating stuff, or is it more like Wild West and this is not something we destroy own economy with?
Well, yeah, I'm chuckling because it's kind of a... it's more of a, the laws around that are more of a weapon than they are anything else. So they're not enforced, generally speaking, but they are enforced if somebody's trying to, make some kind of statement. So from time to time, you'll hear a rumor that, they're going to be inspecting all the cyber cafes to make sure that they are, not running pirated software. And so everybody will switch over to, something else like Ubuntu or, and you'll have this wave of change happen, and then it'll revert back. And it depends what people are used to and what works for business. The cyber cafes are a really interesting space. I mean, so an example of that is when they did switch to Ubuntu, all their users couldn't get it, couldn't understand it. So they just switched back to the Windows operating system. I'm speaking in broad brush strokes here. But generally speaking, they all moved back into a Windows model just because that's what customers actually could understand. It was a user experience problem.
Mm, it's sad. That's sad. Maybe we should have, given workshops for how to use Ubuntu
It's a complicated one.
The difference is really not that great. I mean, if you use Ubuntu with GNOME, it's nearly an XP clone anyway.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I don't know exactly, which Ubuntu distro they were using for it either, but, it was kind of one of those things that it soured a bunch of cyber cafe owners to that open source, system, and then they switched back. So, that's just, one of the repercussions of what's happened out here with it. But that's just on, there's another side of open source that's interesting too, and that is going for government tenders, and which is generally speaking about 60%, 50 to 60% of the money in the tech space generates from government contracts.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's interesting how the open source community in places like Kenya that are maybe further along, in Ghana, have really lobbied for government to open up to some more open source standards. It doesn't happen all the time because, you know, at the same time, you know, the groups like Microsoft are also lobbying. Mm-hmm. But, you know, generally speaking, we've had a more, you know, more open tenders. As long as you can prove that you have the organization to back it up and do the maintenance and everything, you actually have a decent shot at the contract.
And are there any accomplishments concerning open data or open government you could name?
Well, there's some people trying. So, you know, the permanent secretary here in Kenya for information and communications started an open data initiative, but there's not that much open data on that site yet. There's only, you know, a couple of files. So the problem is that the Ministry of Information and Communications might say we're going to do this, but the other ministries just won't open up the data. Mm-hmm. So, and Kenya is one of the more forward-looking in that space as far as open data is concerned around the continent. And so I wouldn't say there's any wild success stories from that side yet.
Hmm. Hopefully there will be. One last general issue I want to ask you about before we come to the project. And I want to ask this question to every area I'm doing interviews with. How is the issue of net neutrality addressed in your country, if it is addressed? You know, on one hand, that every bit is the same and you don't make differentiation or quality of service. And on the other hand, about censorship in the net, that maybe you go down to DNS filtering or deep packet inspection.
Yeah, well, so here, there's just not a whole lot of awareness of net neutrality at all. And that means that the operators, like the mobile operators who are becoming ISPs and ISPs themselves, are more free to do what they want than elsewhere. So, you know, it's one of those areas that, you know, needs some more attention, let me put it that way. On the other side, you know, where you talk about, I guess the other side of net neutrality or of at least of the question that I heard from you was, you know, how about filtering for certain types of things like in Sudan, you know, there's a lot of filtering for political stuff for religious stuff. In Ethiopia, there's a lot of filtering for political stuff. In Kenya, there's actually not that much filtering. The government doesn't ban a whole bunch of different kinds of things. And so country by country, we have different norms. In Kenya, it's been fairly open. There has been a new law passed, a communications law that allows the ability to shut off any source of information, but it's not been used yet.
Mm-hmm. Do you know which technology they would use to shut down a site? Just DNS filtering or blocked IP?
You know, that I don't know yet. I don't even know what technology they have behind it. I do know that there's been some hiring in the government for security positions. Not just security of the network, but security as far as being able to shut down and also buying certain types of software to use for that purpose.
Mm. Okay, now let's go to the really interesting stuff. Let's speak about your biggest project. Ushahidi, it's the name, and maybe you explain it. You can do it best.
Sure thing. So yeah, Ushahidi is a nonprofit tech company. You can think of us like you would Mozilla, you know, with Firefox. We have our software is the Ushahidi platform. And the Ushahidi platform is a free and open source tool for information collection and visualization and mapping. So crowdsourcing and mapping application. And it's used all over the world now. We initially developed it in Kenya back in the 2008 post-election violence. A couple of us came together as an ad hoc group and built it. And then, 4 months later, we became an organization. We got funding after that from a private foundation and rebuilt the tool from the ground up as a LAMP stack. So, you know, Linux and Apache, MySQL and PHP. And now it's open source available for anybody in the world to use. What happened was, I guess this year has been the really big year for Ushahidi, starting with Haiti, the earthquake in Haiti. The tool was deployed and quickly started gathering data from ordinary people via SMS and email and the web. And that then meant that all the relief organizations were going to that same tool to gather the information and go and help people on the ground. Now, we partnered with a bunch of organizations to make that happen. And so it was really one of the first big uses of the tool in a humanitarian crisis. We've also seen Ushahidi being used quite a bit in the election monitoring space, both in Africa and places like Kenya and Tanzania just this year, as well as places like Afghanistan and Mexico and India. And actually, most South American countries are now using it as well. So it's found quite a few places. But the biggest deployment of Ushahidi this year that most people don't realize was in Russia. Mm-hmm. They downloaded the software and deployed it for the problems with the Russian fires. And it just had a massive user base. And that was all community-led. So it's that kind of thing that we build for. We build a platform for this aggregation of crowdsourced data so that it can be used by anybody for things that we could never have thought of back in 2008.
Mm-hmm. And so you have the software as a full package from Apache Data up to the application logic, and then someone can install it on server for his purpose, for this crisis, which is actually right now in my country, or this election where I want to have this aggregated crowd information about what's happening at the election offices, whichever purpose, but you give the software, so to say, and the possibility to run your own platform for aggregation of information.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the point here is we basically make the software as simple to deploy as possible. So what took us 2 to 3 days to build back in 2008, if you're setting it up on your own server, should take you just a couple hours, 2 to 3 hours. And then this summer, we released a new tool, which is it's basically Ushahidi in the, you know, on the server in the cloud, which is CrowdMap. CrowdMap.com is a way that you can get going with Ushahidi in like 2 to 3 minutes. So the thing is, we're trying to make it easier and easier for you to deploy crowdsourcing tools like Ushahidi in ways so that you don't have to bury yourself in all the details of what it is when the crisis happens. Mm-hmm. And now it's important to note that it's not just crisis it's being used for. We're seeing a lot of really creative uses of it around the world. You know, they have a bully mapping deployment of it in Australia, and you know the Italians are using it to for the firefighters and the communities around the fire community to connect with each other. You know, the Kenya AIDS NGO consortium uses it to track who's doing what around the country. So it's not always crisis. It's also just community aggregation and visualizations.
Mm-hmm. I think The most important part of this software is the map, and it's all very location based. And mm-hmm. as you said, it's always focused on one area and on one issue or various issues. And so the information can come from many different ways. And do you make any verification of where yeah. is this SMS really coming from, or this email, and is this possibly a scam or someone trying to influence the picture?
Yeah, you know, there's different things that happen. Number one, whoever deploys the software has to do their own verification. And, you know, when it's coming via SMS, that has to be done manually quite a bit. And so, for instance, like when we did the Tanzanian elections 2 weeks ago, or the Kenyan referendum in August, we had, you know, teams of about 40 or 80 people who would be sitting there and sifting through the SMSs and either, you know, pushing them to urgent status or trying to figure out where the location was by asking the person where they sent the message from, because quite frankly, it's hard to get somebody's location in 160 characters. Yeah. So that's a problem that you have to deal with, and it's more of an information management issue. So one of the tools that we built to help deal with this is we call Swift River. Swift River is a tool that helps us apply filters using just ordinary algorithms for either natural language processing or duplications or location that helps us sift through the information before it gets to people. And that allows us to have, I guess, a probability score would be the best way to tell mm-hmm. a probability score if something should be paid attention to or not. And so SwiftRiver is really about understanding the veracity of information before it ever reaches to a person's eyeballs. And then, you know, so therefore cutting down on the volume. And why this is important is in places like Haiti, we had 80,000 SMS messages coming through. And that's not counting the Twitter messages or the emails or the web-based reports that were being sent in. So, you know, there's a huge volume in some of these crisis situations that is very hard to deal with. And there's no tool that deals with it right now. Mm. So that's why it's important.
It sounds like very interesting because it fills up this gap between normal journalism and citizen journalism, citizen reporters, and it lowers the level of knowledge one has to have to engage and to put their own information through. And can you really go down then in the active system to what was said? What were the messages that came in from this area or this location?
You can. If you're on the map of a deployment, you can click on any single report and go down to the exact message and even leave a comment. So last year was interesting. Al Jazeera deployed Ushahidi during the Gaza conflict, and what happened was there was reports coming in from both sides of the border, from Palestinians and from Israelis, you know, talking about rocket attacks or some kind of gas or whatever it was. And there was a lot of commentary on certain reports where people were debating facts and debating what happened and why it happened from both sides of the border. And, you know, I think that kind of information, though, you know, as a single report compared to maybe a media report, isn't quite as interesting. As a mass, it definitely is. So what we've found is that, and this is why it was important back in 2008 in Kenya, is that in a crisis or a disaster or emergency scenario, most of the information comes from the top down. It comes from government or international NGOs or the media. And for the first time, there was a chance to pull the information from the bottom up. And if you combine both sides, the top down and the bottom up, you get a much more holistic view. Exactly. And so that's what, you know, has been applied to election monitoring now and other emergencies. And all of a sudden you have a better picture. It's not any one of those things is not the whole picture, but combined, they tell a very interesting story.
Mm-hmm. And I guess you drove a lot of attention with this project. I mean, has there been any media coverage about? Because I really haven't heard of it before. Maybe this is like in my general knowledge, but this would be something you usually you want to deploy it very widely, or you want to suppress it, and. Have the media, did they really use the information you gathered? I don't know. When Al Jazeera used this tool, for example, in Palestine, I guess that they at least used it and also had it in their normal reports about that area.
Yeah, so actually it's used quite a bit by the media. But it's also used by the media, they deploy their own as well sometimes. So, for example, of course, Al Jazeera deployed it, but also just last month, the BBC deployed it, deployed CrowdMap for their tube strike in London. And then we have The Guardian also in the UK deploying it for budget cuts, tracking what budget cuts repercussions there are and by ordinary people telling what's going on around them. And then there's, you know, The Washington Post earlier this year in the US, they also deployed it to track a big snow blizzard that had come through, a snowstorm, and where people could help, where people needed help, those kinds of things. So, again, none of those are exact replicas of each other. They're different types of uses for engaging with the community, gathering information from them, and then sharing it openly.
Where do you want to go with your project? I mean, it looks like you are a big success already, but do you plan to implement new features, new channels of information gathering, or new aggregation types? What are you heading for?
Yeah, well, I think there's always further refinement of the tool that's needed. You know, it can always get better. So we actually have version 2 of Ushahidi coming out this week, which is a pretty big thing for us. Means that we've done quite a bit of replumbing of the system, making it easier for people to use and upgrade and all those kinds of things. But really, you know, to understand Ushahidi as a platform, you have to understand Ushahidi as an organization. And what we really do is try and build tools for democratizing information, increasing transparency, and lowering the barriers for individuals to share their stories, right? That's what we're trying to do. How you use it in your community is up to you. We're trying to provide you the tools to make that happen. And so whether it's Ushahidi as the platform, CrowdMap as a server-based one, or SwiftRiver to help you understand the veracity of incoming information, you know, whatever it is, we're trying to increase the ability for you to do it and to make it better at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And maybe when we air this in the Hackerspaces show, there would be some people who would like to help. Is there any specific part where you could need some more programmers or people who make, fundraising or put more attention to your project?
Yeah, I mean, Ushahidi is, you know, survives because of the developer community and the user community. So if you're a developer or, programmer, if you know PHP, JavaScript, I mean, there's areas that need improvement, whether it's, you know, coming up with new customized themes, if you're more on the markup side, or if you're good with JavaScript, we could really use some help. We're trying to rethink how we do the math and timeline integration and make it better. We're trying to think of new ways to analyze the information that's coming in so that the people who are deploying the software can make better sense of it rather than just the map and just the timeline. And, you know, if you're more of a system architect level, we would, we appreciate anybody who can come in and help us refine the whole plugin architecture level to make it easier for people to use, make it a faster application, those kind of things.
Let's talk about the iHub, the place where you are right now. Can you tell us more about this?
Yeah, the iHub is the innovation hub in Nairobi, and it's an open space for the technology community to come together. Part of it's co-working space, part of it's a coffee shop and a community commons where events can be held. And it's also the place where different, you know, silos of the community can come together in a neutral territory. So whether you're coming from the corporate world or, you know, you're a university grad or maybe you work in the government, you know, everybody's welcome here and it's neutral territory. We built the place, or we started building the place just in March of this year, and it's already getting quite a bit of use. As I look around, there's approximately 30, coders and designers using the space, and it gets quite a bit of use. We have some corporate partners, Google Kenya, Microsoft East Africa, Nokia Research Center, and Wananchi, one of the big local ISPs. We have, you know, fast fiber bandwidth to the room, and it gets quite a bit of use because of that.
Mm-hmm. And what's necessary to come to this iHub? Is it an organization you have to join, or can you just come there with your laptop and work?
Well, we wanted to keep it as open as possible, but what we found is we walked into a vacuum, and when we announced it, we didn't realize quite how much demand there would be. We set up a membership structure. Basically, it's free to use the space if you can basically work your way through the membership process. We have over 1,700 members who signed up online to be able to use all the stuff that we have online, and then we let in our first wave of 100 members, which we call which are the green level members, who can actually use the space. We're trying to stress test how much the location can handle, But we think we're going to open up another wave for another 50 or 100 in a couple of weeks. And then there's visitor passes. So if you're ever coming through and you just want to sit down and hack for a day or whatever, you can just come in and get one of those and sit down and keep coding or doing whatever that it is that you do. The basics is this. Show your tech cred in the community. Why should you use this space? And if you can do that, then it's open to you.
And is it what are the people doing in there? Is it mostly coding stuff, or do you also have a hardware section, for example?
Well, I wish we had enough space for a hardware section, but we really don't. We would need to probably double the space to do that. We have mostly software developers, let's say about 70%, and then about 20% designers, and then the other 10% is, you know, guys who are tech business guys or researchers, maybe a couple bloggers. That's the kind of makeup of the space right now. Mm-hmm. But it's much heavier towards the coder, software developer than it is to anything else.
And what's the story? Why did you start at this place? Was that you just saw the demand and then decided you want to do something like that? Or was there an inspiration from other hacker spaces?
Yeah, well, so, you know, you have to go back a couple of years to see where the inspiration for this came from. So back in 2008, we had a bar camp, you know, an unconference here that had quite a few attendees. And one of the attendees was one of the guys who had started up the local tech listserv, which is highly used. It's called Skunkworks. And we were sitting around talking about, you know, it's too bad that we only get to see each other when we have these conferences. And there surely would be a need for a static space that anybody could come to anytime. And so, you know, that was the general beginnings of the idea. Then over the next year, it was refined and we found that nobody really wanted to fund it without putting their big logo on it. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, Ushahidi, we just decided we're going to fund it ourselves. And we got the money together from our funders, who were at that time Midyar Network and Hivos, and built the space this year. And so that's the genesis of the iHub. And we didn't, again, realize how much in demand a space like this would be. Both the people who are running freelance, maybe it's a designer meetup, those kind of things.
We had a problem. I think the last 10 seconds we didn't hear you.
Okay. So I was saying it's used by quite a few people from different walks of life in the tech community. Sometimes it's used for events and you know, so if you want to run a PHP user group meeting or if you want to run a designer get together, you know, that's what the space is used for as well.
And do you have conferences in Nairobi or anywhere in your part of Africa where also the people gather and things are discussed? Also something maybe where people could fly to if they want to visit an African conference?
Oh, definitely. We have, about every year we run a bar camp, which is a fun kind of open environment for a conference. And those are really some of the best to come to because everybody comes out for it. Just this year we ran it, we had over 600 people on the first day alone. So it becomes a pretty big deal. But there's some other conferences that go on as well. Some of them run by corporates. So we had, you know, the Google Kenya conference here and things like that. But we also have the ATEC conference and what's the other one? Oh, there's a really good one that looks like it'll be in the first couple months again of 2011, which is the Mobile Web East Africa Conference. And we're planning to run a big event ourselves around June of next year. So keep your eyes on the iHub blog for that. But it'll be around mobile technology primarily.
And have you been to any conferences outside of Africa?
Yeah, I go to quite a few just because of my job. I do, besides the just normal tech web conferences, there's Tech for Africa and Web 2.0 kind of things. But I'm also a TED fellow, so I go to the TED conference to be a part of that. I'm also a PopTech fellow, and so I attend those every year.
That's also a label which works, and yeah. Another issue I want to talk about before we come to the end of the show. I found this out in some things I wrote, read about you. This topic of African futurism, African visions about the future.
Mm-hmm.
What's your vision for Africa for the future?
Well, I look at technology as a way to overcome inefficiencies. And so there's a lot of inefficiencies in Africa, whether it's a government side thing or an infrastructure side thing. And so technology can help us overcome these problems. And in a way, Ushahidi is one of those tools that has helping to overcome inefficiencies in information flow. When I look at Africa, I see that there's certain hubs for it to happen. You need certain types of critical mass to make it work. That means that certain areas are better than others. And when I look across Africa, I see five major hubs. They're all cities. It's Johannesburg, of course, and there's also Accra, Ghana, and Lagos, and Cairo and Nairobi. Those are the five big hubs for technology in Africa. And I think that we're going to continue to see a lot of innovation and ideas and technologies and projects and products come from these places. And so what's going to happen is that more people will move to them if they're from those regions. And we're going to see more products that come out regionally that make a big hit, like M-Pesa has done or like Mixit has done in South Africa. And we're also going to see ones that go across the continent and around the world, things like Ushahidi. And so I think we're just on the very front edge of this, where the critical mass is just now being reached, where it might have been reached 10 years ago in Europe. It's just getting there now in places like Kenya and Ghana and South Africa. And so it's only going to grow as the business people understand how to make money off of it and the technologists get better at making the tools.
Mm-hmm. And it will be very interesting what the effect will really be for the whole area of the other side of the digital divide.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think it's going to be interesting because there's, huge swaths of industries. Everything from the humanitarian industry to, bottling and manufacturing. The whole gamut needs to be made more efficient, and technology is the tool that will allow that to happen.
Good. Eric, any topic we forget to talk about, which I completely missed out so far?
Well, we covered quite a bit. I think we've covered about everything. One thing that I think is interesting and that hasn't been done yet is we started off with, so I'll take us full circle. We talk about hardware. We have the innovation hub, the iHub here in Nairobi for software, mobile website things. But What we're lacking is something on the hardware side for the same thing. I'd love to see a hacker garage of some sort in one of the major hubs in Africa, because I think there's a lot that's not being done on the hardware side just because of lack of access to the tools. And I think these are things that could be sold. They have, there's a real market for inventive new tools that actually fit the African context, whether it's power supplies or communications. So I think that's a place that's really interesting that has yet to be opened up.
I would love to see it soon.
Yeah, me too.
Maybe we could send you Mitch Altman. He's usually quite good with getting people motivated to do some more with hardware.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Good. Eric, then I thank you very much for this interview. We can collect a lot of links together to use this show as a starting point for further research or engagement in other projects.
Excellent.
It's really great what you do. I will follow all these projects and keep on reading you. And yeah, thank you very much for this interview.
Great. Thank you so much, Thomas, for having me. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Okay. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
So, this was Eric Hirschman, and now for the remaining time, we come to another interview to Valerie Cologne, and he will tell us about his project, how He uses mobile technology to circumvent men in the middle. Here it goes. Explain to me what AgroHub is about.
Okay, AgroHub is just it's just a business venture that we set up to be able to mine data, that's crowdsource data from the local population and disseminate this information via the mobile phone. We realized that essentially there's a lack in agricultural information amongst the agricultural sector, and that's what makes things difficult and eventually makes our agricultural markets in Cameroon don't work. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we are trying to fix that by building an SMS-based platform that could be used to interchange information among stakeholders in Cameroon. So farmers on the field could report information to us, while customers who want to buy from farmers could report to us, and we can, through the server, connect these two stakeholders for mutual benefiting relationship.
Mm-hmm. So what you do is you make a direct connection between the farmers on their land and the people in the city who want to buy their crops.
Exactly.
And so, that's a very clever trick, because so you circumvent the normal people in between and the usual market in the city.
Exactly. Because currently what happens is middlemen go to the villages and buy from the farmers very cheap, and they sell at the cities expensive, and they make all the gain in between. And the farmers who work on the farms usually have nothing on their own. So we want to try to, you know, bridge this information and communication gap that exists between the final consumer and the producer, who are the farmers, for their own mutual benefiting relationship. Yeah.
And give me some numbers. Have you just started, or how many farmers do you have? How much crops do you have in your system?
Okay. Currently, we started a pilot not more than a month ago, and we've registered 200 farmers right now. So we, for now, still have a lot of difficulty sending information out, because SMS in Cameroon is not cheap. Mm-hmm. So it's still very pricey, and that makes us to be a little bit far behind. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But currently we have 200 farmers registered.
Mm-hmm.
And we send them information not as regular as we thought it would be, or as we anticipated, because for now we're still seeking funding for the initiative.
So you are still right at the beginning after 1 month in this project, but where do you want to go with it? What's the target? Do you want to go for whole Africa and the whole world at one stage, or?
Well, the project was conceived back in 2008. In 2009, in my search for funding, I went to San Jose to even defend the project during the mobile challenge, NetSquared the F4 mobile challenge. By then, the project was called AMIS, Agricultural Market Information Service. Mm-hmm. In late 2009, I rebranded it to AgroHub. Yeah, so all the time looking for funding, trying to sensitize the farmers, and also to develop the mobile platform. Yeah, because we're using a combination of open source tools, Drupal, frontline SMS, and the like. Yeah, and really we started piloting the project for 1 month ago, like I said. So our target currently is focused on Cameroon, because that's our prime target. We want to make our own local community better. But if this model works, then we can replicate it all over Africa.
How do you make the connection with the farmers? Do you have to go to them, or can they register with SMS too, or do they have to come to you?
Okay, currently the agricultural system is organized in such a way that farmers are organized in groups, CIGs. So we moved to the Delegation of Agriculture, and we had them forms. They subsequently sent down these forms to the heads of the CIGs. They register and they send back the form to them, and then we finally get it from the Delegation of Agriculture. This because we currently take a lot of information on about the farmers, like their date of birth, how long they have been in farming, their age, you know. All this is to really gather statistics so that we can in the long run or midterm, like in 2 years, know exactly the age range of farmers that are involved in agriculture in Cameroon and, you know, other activities. So it's really for statistical purpose. And that information, well, I would say it could be slightly convenient to send all of that through SMS. However, since we are just starting, we are thinking that we should be allowed to register via SMS. Mm. Yeah.
What's the price difference between the price from the farmers and the price the middlemen give? How big is the gap?
I would say, without equivocation, that is, we estimate from our market research that it's about 40% difference. Yeah, because 40% difference, that's what they get as extra kind of income or gain that they make. That's after deducting all the costs of transportation and all that. We estimate it's 40%. That's the gap. And that 40% goes directly to the middleman.
So you aim for some price in between, and the transportation then has to be done by the people who buy the crops, or?
Co-op will have to arrange transportations if large quantities are being bought by customers or by the consumers. So essentially, we are trying to facilitate also the transportation. That's why AgriHub exists in two models. We have AgriHub Informer and AgriHub Trader. The Informer is the non-profit part, which is there to just disseminate information. And the Trader part is the for-profit part, which comes to create distribution channels, maybe by engaging in trading through the web, by selling to markets abroad, or to create other trading channels like supermarkets, groceries, salad bar, and many more, like food restaurants. So that's the role of AgriHub, the trader. So we aim to try to create these distribution channels, because currently it's difficult for food crops to move from the villages to the cities. So we also try to make that better, because at least with some arrangements, if you have a target, you just move there straight and get these crops out of the villages, rather than going there when you don't have information. I mean, you could easily be stranded, and that increases the cost of these commodities.
You already have a business plan. That's very nice, because usually a startup after 1 month has maybe a great idea and a great homepage, but they don't know so far how they want to make money. And you already know that. This is great.
Exactly. Yeah, thanks.
And also I like that you are dealing with the periphery, with the villages, with the remote areas. Usually no one looks after these people, and you wouldn't think that information technology can help them.
Exactly. You know, the prime objective, how I got into this idea is the fact that myself, I come from a farming background. My family and I worked on the farm until when I got to university. I saw how we struggle on the farm, work so hard, but usually at the end of the year or at the beginning of each academic year, it was difficult for my parents to pay my fees. They always complain they don't have money. And how much was that fee? It was just around 20 US dollars, you know, the equivalent. So I felt so bad. And when I got to university, I thought that it would be right if I could solve this problem. And I finally got the clue when I studied marketing, emerging markets through like eBay, Amazon, and my involvement with information technology. So I thought it could be good to use this combination to try to solve the problems our farmers are facing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like the idea, and I think you did a great thing there. and combine two things that really should work together. And how can one help you? Is there anything you need? Do you need programmers? Do you need funding? Do you need more attention in the media?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I would say all of what you mentioned. Currently, I'm the lead programmer on the team, and the work is kind of too demanding for me. So I would obviously need the help of programmers. Obviously, funding has been one of the major difficulties that we have, because in Cameroon, SMS is currently sold at 50 francs per SMS. So it's still very pricey, and we hope that we can engage in partnership with some of the mobile telecommunication companies like MTN or Orange, who can give us SMS maybe at a subsidized rate, or why not even for free. Actually, we are young businessmen, my partner and I, so we would definitely need training or kind of support in terms of developing our business skills. You know, I may not know half all the answers. Yeah, so I'm really looking forward to maybe hone my business skills. Yeah.
Is there anything I forgot that you want to mention?
Yeah, absolutely. I thought you were trying to talk about Africa and technology in general. So, we didn't mention ActiveSpace, which is like an umbrella hosting us now, because AgroHub doesn't have money to pay office space and Claire, but thanks to ActiveSpace, we have been able to secure an office. So ActiveSpace is just an initiative to groom entrepreneurs in Africa, even though we are more biased to tech entrepreneurship. Yeah, so ActiveSpace is really a way to bring African or Cameroonian entrepreneurs together. So that's an initiative which is currently co-founded by Bill and myself and a couple of others. Yeah, so I thought we were going to mention that too. But anyway, we can talk that for later show.
Yeah, I think we should have another show. And I will put your contact on the list that people can get direct in contact with you and send you when they have an idea how they could engage in your project.
Okay.
And I will also link to ActiveSpace and all the other hackerspaces in Africa I found.
Exactly. Yeah.
Good. Then thank you very much, Valerie, and I hope we hear us another time.
Yeah, sure. Definitely we'll be in touch. I mean, I'm always willing to help and to answer questions from any other person. Yeah.
Good. Then thank you very much.